Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Thursday, April 20th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Kendra Nordine Beato.
And I'm Clara Germani.
Say the words, "Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret." And many women may recall just where they were when they first heard about the coming-of-age book by Judy Blume, published in 1970. Ms. Blume has been granted entry as a confidant into a place where few are admitted, the tween bedroom. Her character, Margaret Simon, explores questions all young girls wonder about but are too embarrassed to ask. When I started reporting on Ms. Blume's lasting appeal over the past 50 years, which you can read about in today's Daily, I wanted to reread the book. I could visualize the purple paperback cover with Margaret's flowing blonde hair, and I dug through boxes in the attic looking for it. But my copy is long gone. I stopped by the local library. Both copies were checked out. Next, I searched eBay. Even though the book is still in print, it turns out nostalgia for certain covers comes at a cost. I spotted the familiar 1977 edition for $85, so I passed. Finally, in a tiny bookshop on Beacon Hill in Boston, I found the title on a low shelf. Somehow, seventh grader Margaret, after five decades, is still holding her own among today's vampire trilogies, dystopian stories, and graphic novels. The cover of my new copy features Abby Ryder Fortson, the young actor who portrays Margaret in a new motion picture that opens April 28th. At the bookshop, I headed down to the cafe to meet a friend. The chef, dressed in a crisp white coat, led us to our table. I set down my newly purchased book, and that's when she paused. She placed one hand on the book and the other on her heart, and turning to me, she said, "I remember exactly where I was when I read this book and how it made me feel." And I knew just what she meant. Now, today's stories. Our first story. The Republican Party won a victory in overturning Roe v. Wade, but it may have put itself in a more precarious position politically. Candidates are navigating a new landscape, often silently or awkwardly.
When Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appeared last Friday at the Christian Conservative Liberty University in Virginia, hours after quietly signing a ban on abortions beyond 6 weeks of gestation, he didn't mention the topic. Meanwhile, fellow Republican Nikki Haley on the presidential campaign trail in Iowa doesn't mention abortion until asked. "I'm strongly pro-life," she says, noting that her husband is adopted and that she had trouble conceiving both of her children. Still, she's quick to add, "I don't judge anyone that's pro-choice any more than I want them to judge me being pro-life." The awkwardness and hesitancy on display among prominent Republicans when talking about abortion these days reflect a profound challenge facing their party heading into 2024. The overturning of Roe v. Wade set off a political backlash that has energized Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents, as seen in votes in Wisconsin, Kansas, and other states since the ruling. The few Republicans in Congress willing to carve out a middle ground on abortion suggest that their efforts are a work in progress. Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina has been a lonely voice on the matter, calling herself pro-life, but also saying that she'd lean toward banning the procedure after 15 to 20 weeks of gestation. This story was reported by Linda Feldman and Story Hinckley in Washington and Des Moines, Iowa, for The Monitor.
The Arab Spring has turned into more of an Arab ice age, as autocrats throughout the region solidify their power. Washington faces a difficult but familiar choice: to back democracy or stability.
12 years ago this week, 100,000 Syrians packed into the main square of Homs to demand that President Bashar al-Assad resign. Today, after a brutal civil war that has killed hundreds of thousands of Syrians and seen government forces use tanks, indiscriminate airstrikes, poison gas, and Russian military assistance to help to preserve his power, Mr. Assad is taking a diplomatic victory lap. Last week, his foreign minister, Faisal Mekdad, was discussing with neighboring states whether the Arab League might lift its 12-year suspension of Syrian participation in the group. This week, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister traveled to Damascus, while Mr. Mekdad flew to Tunisia to restore bilateral relations. The Arab Spring is looking more like an Arab ice age, with autocrats back in charge in Tunisia and Egypt, and still in charge throughout the Gulf. Syria's rapprochement with its dictatorial neighbors raises thorny questions for U.S. policy in a region where Russia and China are wielding ever greater influence. It also highlights a core tension that has long vexed Washington's Mideast policy between a commitment to human rights and reliance on alliances with Arab states that routinely violate those rights. That's no easier to resolve today than it's ever been. This story was reported by Ned Temko in London for The Monitor.
What would the end of affirmative action mean for students and their families? And how will colleges and universities pivot from what has been an entrenched status quo?
High school seniors all over the United States this month are getting their college acceptance letters, and it may be the last time that those letters go out under the system of affirmative action that has been in place in the U.S. for more than 50 years. By the end of June, the Supreme Court is expected to rule on a case that may well end the practice of considering race as one facet of admissions in all U.S.-based institutions of higher learning. On three occasions, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld on narrow grounds the constitutionality of race-based affirmative action in university admissions. But as it prepares to rule in two cases involving admissions policies at Harvard University and the University of North Carolina, the court appears poised to overturn that precedent. Today's Supreme Court appears likely to rule against Harvard and UNC. The next, and harder to predict question, how broad will the ruling be? This story was reported by Henry Gass, an iReporter for The Monitor.
What makes a young adult novel that deals honestly with puberty endure across generations of women?
Judy Blume has been giving tween girls something to talk about ever since Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret was published in 1970. Her iconic novel has been celebrated as a relatable guide for adolescent girls as much as it has been banned for its matter-of-fact discussions of menstruation. A new generation will get its chance to meet Margaret this month when a big-screen version arrives April 28th. She wrote a story that feels universal and relatable to anybody, any decade, says director and screenwriter Kelly Freeman Craig in a Zoom interview. When something is written with real honesty, that's the effect it has. The story centers on Margaret Simon, who is navigating a new school and friends right at a time when she is feeling particularly self-conscious. Not sure what to do with her big feelings and questions, she shares her confusion directly with God. After a recent screening in Cambridge, Massachusetts, one college student says she connected with the story, even though she never read the book. It was so realistic, enthuses Sophia Paris, who says she used to pray to God to help her grow taller. It really appealed to the kid in you and brought back all those awkward feelings. This story was reported by Kendra Nordine Beato for The Monitor.
Kolkata's aging trams point toward a climate solution, But more importantly, for others, they also provide a reminder of a simpler and slower time.
Kolkata's electric trams don't just take passengers through the city, they take them through time. For about 15 rupees, or $1.80, the trams offer a window into Kolkata's past of colonial buildings, grand mansions, beautiful bookstores, and old markets. As passengers amble along, everything from savory street foods to traditional sweets is within arm's reach. Kolkata's trams, which originated with horse-drawn rail systems under British rule, have spent recent decades atrophying for lack of riders. But lately, there's been a resurgence of interest among enthusiasts and also climate activists. In a time of climate crisis, we need to embrace modes of transport that are sustainable and efficient, says Debashis Bhattacharya, president of the Kolkata Tramway Users Association. For others, trams offer an irreplaceable ambiance, a mellow constant among a vibrant, changing city. I've been riding trams for as long as I can remember, says Pranab Chakraborty, who is in his 70s. It reminds me of my childhood when life was simpler and slower. This story was written by Amar Khan in Kolkata, India, for The Monitor.
Now, commentary from The Monitor's editorial board on freeing the truth for freedom of the seas. With so many official lies on social media, many more governments are getting better at pushing the truth. Ukraine, for example, has convinced most of the world, reflected in a United Nations vote last year, that, contrary to Kremlin claims, it was indeed invaded and is not led by neo-Nazis. Now, the Philippines has followed suit with its own truth-telling campaign, one designed to expose China's military aggression within the legal domain of Philippine waters and islands in the South China Sea. Since February, after a Chinese ship used a military-grade laser to blind Filipino sailors on patrol in their own maritime territory, the government in Manila has taken journalists to see China's swarm of ships and frequent provocations within the Philippine maritime zone. With video recordings, the Philippines can readily counter China's fanciful claim that its control of islands 1,000 miles from its shores is merely peaceful. In today's globe-spanning digital universe, transparency is proving to be a defensive weapon. As a Philippine Navy Commodore states, by continuing to document and publicize these Chinese incidents, the international community can build a strong case against China's actions and potentially force it to alter its behavior. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. For more Monitor audio, including our serial podcasts, go to csmonitor.com/podcasts or find us free wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us. Please come back tomorrow when we'll have a podcast episode with The Monitor's Krista Case Bryant and Stephanie Haynes, who both brought a love of the outdoors to their recent climate-related cover story. Also, we wanted to share an update on our format. We've changed the look of our photo captions in the Daily and on csmonitor.com. Captions are now collapsed by default, allowing a smoother, simplified reading experience. To read a caption, click View Caption under the photo. Let us know what you think. Email us at daily@csmonitor.com. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how perfection may seem unattainable, but when we consider things through a spiritual lens, we discover more of the spiritual perfection God expresses in us, which brings healing. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton and Troy Sambajon.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor in Boston, Massachusetts, USA. Copyright 2023.